Welcome to Local Talk Wednesday on KHOI Community Radio, where we explore people, stories, and events in our seven-county listening area in central Iowa. I'm one of your hosts for today, Susan Franzen, welcoming you to the show.
And I'm Ursula Rudenberg, your co-host, and it's great to have you with us. Thanks for listening in. It looks like we're in for a rainy day today and tomorrow. This is what my grandmother used to call transition weather. And it is getting colder. All the beautiful weather is coming to an end, but they say sunny days will return by the weekend, and we're going to be experiencing temperatures mostly in the 40s and the 50s.
We've certainly been lucky with our weather so far this fall. Lots of beautiful sunny days and our first frost just last week. I've been waiting for the cold weather that's supposed to come before we can call it Indian summer. In spite of the pleasant temperatures, it's only in the last week I've really noticed many trees turning.
Well, my favorite tree, and I keep talking about this tree, is just ending its glory. There's one particular tree, which is on Northwestern near 8th Street, and I just love it the most, hands down. It's a maple, and every year it gives the most incredible blend of green, yellow, orange, and red. And it's the particular way this tree blends those colors that just really knocks me out. And it has a beautiful shape, and I suppose maple trees are just about everybody's favorite.
Well, for a day or two, maybe. But the oaks are really my favorites because some of them keep their leaves all winter. I wondered why it is that some trees turn sooner than others and lose their leaves earlier. Then I was told that the person to ask was Jesse Randall, Extension Forestry Specialist. So I recorded his answer to my question, which I'll play in a few minutes.
And this is Local Talk Wednesday, so on this day we'll be traveling to different communities, and today possibly even through time. And it's Halloween time, so we decided to go to a cemetery. We're going to visit a pioneer cemetery near the extinct town of Bloomington. We'll have some guides who went there with us, and then we'll have our usual segment of Tuning Into Agriculture. We'll take us to some unusually diversified agriculture at Center Grove Orchard.
Before we embark on our expeditions in time and space, let's answer our leaf questions. Before I met Jesse Randall, I checked out his website and found there was a lot of information already there. So I asked him about it.
The extension system throughout the entire United States is a very trusted, very old source of good information. That's their business, is to take scientific discovery and put it into a form that is available for the everyday public to use. And it is our job in Extension to vet that information. And we put it out online now. We have the printed publication still moving towards electronic delivery now. Anytime you can get to the land-grant institution, Iowa State University is our land-grant institution in the state of Iowa. Same for University of Wisconsin. Madison is their land-grant institution. You look for that extension information, and you already know that's a trusted source.
On your website, you also include the phone number of the leaf line. Now, that's not an extension, though.
That is an extension, but it's one of those links to the Iowa DNR, and the DNR is another one of those with really good information. DNR as a whole, they pride themselves on having good information, and we work closely with the DNR, and a lot of times we're creating that information jointly. But I didn't want to reinvent the wheel. They have a great site. Their district foresters and their area foresters across the state we'll call in with information pertaining to how the leaves are changing in the state and throughout. So the area foresters, the district foresters call in and they update the database daily or weekly throughout that fall color change period. So you can go on, you can get to that leaf line, and you can see what part of the state is changing and how far along it is to really plan your trips to see the colors if you're going up along the Mississippi from southern Iowa to northern Iowa, or if a jaunt across from the Lusk Hills across southern Iowa and then up. It's a great way to really time the peak color emergence here in Iowa.
I noticed on one of the websites that the peak season is between the middle of September and the middle of October, so it must be late this year.
It is late this year. We had a very good growing season. We had a lot of moisture. Trees really grew well this year. And part of that is they grew a lot of leaf area, and they put out a lot of chlorophyll, and those pigments were really striking. And what's been weird this fall, so it's been a good growing season, Trees respond to the photoperiod. How long are our days? They also respond to temperature and frost. And so as trees begin to shut down in a good growing season, some trees will shut down quicker with the shortening day length, not so much temperature related. And those are the leaves that really just fell early this year. The ashes really fell this year. They didn't turn that brilliant purple that we normally think of. They just sort of fell off the tree. Walnuts were gone really quickly. And then some of the others were the maples, where you really think oranges and reds and yellow colors. Those are driven by anthocyanins. And those really popped this year, should be really nice, because the anthocyanins form and are really shown as the chlorophyll production backs down in the fall because of day length and temperature. Chlorophyll backs down and then eventually stops. And that green fades away, and it allows those anthocyanins to show their reds, their yellows, their purples. And so maples, what they're looking for are warm days in the fall that are sunny. They're looking for cool nights that are not real hard freezing, because the freezing kind of shuts that down. And what have we had this fall? We've had a beautiful long fall. It's been warmer than average. It really hasn't frosted all that hard yet. We've had a few, but mild frosts. So really, for maples, it's been a prime year to be yellow and red. A lot of our oaks have been, they've stayed green for such a long time because it was such a good growing season. There's been adequate soil moisture that they're just sort of beginning to turn that brown. They're really not, oaks aren't known to be a real showpiece. Your white oaks and your bur oaks really aren't going to be real vibrant this year. It's more of the maples that we rely on for a lot of the color. That's not to say that the oaks don't add something. They add a really nice brownish, tannish hue to that forest landscape. So it has been late, but that's a function of a very good growing season and a year where we have a delayed frost and a heavy frost.
Well, I have some oak questions.
Okay.
One is, I used to live near Ross Road, and there's a corner of Ross and Highland mm-hmm. that has three or four beautiful red oaks. Mm-hmm. They're not, they're quite red. Mm-hmm. I don't know whether you call those red oaks. Mm-hmm.
They are. They're red oaks. Yep. And you know, when we talk about being kind of a muted color, mm-hmm. the whites and the bur oaks, they kind of go through that yellowish to brownish stage and just kind of stay brown. The red oak in my yard right now is beginning to turn that really nice crimsony red color that you'd expect with a red oak. But even that's been late this year. It's been delayed. It's still a lot of green left in those leaves. My fear there is we're going to get a real hard, we're at the end of October already. We're the last week of October, and we really haven't had a hard-killing frost yet. And my worry is that the reds in those oaks are going to be fairly muted this year if it has a real quick killing frost. And we're supposed to get down into the mid-20s, upper 20s here very shortly, which is going to be enough to shut those down. And you might get, on those red oaks, a couple of days of really nice-looking red.
This is Local Talk on KHOY Community Radio, and I'm Ursula Rudenberg. We were just listening to a conversation between my co-hosts, Susan Franson and Jesse Randall from the ISU Forestry Extension, about the wonderful autumn colors we've just been witnessing this year, and we really have had a wonderful autumn. I don't know anyone who does not love this time of year. Reporter Pat Schlarbaum filed a report with us about why we call it Indian summer.
Today's phenology is the origin of the term Indian summer. Indian summer describes an interesting turn of events that occurs in autumn. After the first frost, a return to summer-like conditions is described as Indian summer. It is first recorded in Letters from an American Farmer, a 1778 work by the French-American soldier turned farmer J.H. St. John de Crevecoeur. End of quote. Then a severe frost succeeds, which prepares it to receive the voluminous coat of snow which is soon to follow, though it is often preceded by a short interval of smoke and mildness called the Indian summer, 1778. There are many references to the term in American literature in the following 100 years or so. In the 1830s, Indian summer began to be used figuratively to refer to any late flowering following a period of decline. It was well enough established as a phrase by 1834 for John Greenleaf Whittier to use the term that way when in his poem Memories he wrote of the Indian summer of the heart. As a climatic event, it is known throughout the world and is technically called a weather singularity. That is, a climatic event that recurs around the same time of year. The frequency, depth, and longevity of the weather pattern is clearly dependent of geography. It is most frequently associated with the eastern and central states, which have a suitable climate to generate the weather pattern, that is, a wide variation of temperature and wind strength from summer to winter. Many of those states are also famous for their areas of hardwood forest, which show up well during the Indian summers when the leaves have already begun to turn and the sun is shining and the sky is clear. Why Indian? Well, no one knows, but as is commonplace when no one knows, many people have guessed. Here are a few of the more commonly repeated guesses. When European settlers first came across the phenomenon in America, it became known as the Indians' summer. The haziness of the Indian summer weather was caused by prairie fires deliberately set by Native American tribes. And this was a strategy. They would burn off the prairie and then the new growth in the spring would attract the buffalo. Also, it was the period when First Nations or Native American peoples harvested their crops in the autumn. The phenomenon was more common in what were then North American Indian territories. One thing for sure, an Indian summer can initiate some of the great autumn activities we exhibit passion for in the outdoors. Activities like digging canna bulbs, gathering prairie seed, applying linseed oil to outdoor wooden products like wooden benches, or applying mink oil preservative to leather products, or just plain winterization projects around the home, to name a few. Whatever autumn tasks an Indian summer can initiate, they're all good. Even mundane tasks as simple as cleaning the floor mats of the vehicle are more pleasurable with an Indian summer backdrop. Most assuredly, Indian summer is considered a bonus of beautiful autumn weather. After our first frost, we want beautiful weather. We want more beautiful weather to enjoy Iowa's natural resources and beautiful lands of Iowa. And this is Pat Schlarbaum, and that's our phenology for today.
The falling leaves drift by the window. The autumn leaves of red and gold. I see your lips, the summer kisses, the sunburned hands I used to hold. Since you went away, the days grow long, and soon I'll hear old winter's song. But I miss you most of all, my darling. When autumn leaves start to fall,
a song that was popular when I was in college and it always takes me back to a long ago world.
This is Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, and I'm Ursula Rudenberg, and your host, one of your hosts today, together with Susan Franson, and we're just taking a moment to savor the last days of fall. And I hope that you're enjoying your fall too. And thanks to Pat Schlarbaum for that report on Indian summer.
Speaking of the last days of fall, Halloween is indeed upon us, so it seemed like it was time for us to visit a graveyard on Local Talk. This being Local Talk Wednesday, we're looking outside Ames. Actually, in doing so, we ended up not only traveling outside Ames, we actually ended up traveling to another time dimension. But let's not get ahead of ourselves. It all started because Ursula kept telling me about her memories of visiting an abandoned graveyard in the woods when she was a teenager.
That's right. Friends and I always heard rumors that there was a graveyard for people who lived in the area who had all supposedly died out before Ames was built. And we actually found the tombstones in the woods one late summer night after we went swimming in a pond somewhere. And it was very exciting and mysterious. So Susan and I decided to investigate.
Yes. After some asking around, we actually learned pretty quickly that there is indeed a pioneer cemetery near the Isaac Walton League Park. We also found two guides for helping us in our search, because we needed somebody who was a member of the Ikes. We set out on Sunday with my husband Fritz and our guides Marvin and Kay Scott to see if we could find the cemetery. First, we fought our way through tangled woods and then walked through a plowed field. We had a recorder on so we could share the experience with you. Here we are, searching for the cemetery.
That looks promising. Let's just...
See the gate?
Oh, wow,
yes, that looks like a serious...
Yeah, that does look like a cemetery.
It's a gate between two wooden posts.
And yeah, look at the fence.
Oh, he found it.
He found a tombstone.
By golly.
There's a tombstone.
Yes, all right.
A tombstone?
There's tombstones right here.
Two of them.
And he has got one down there, too.
Yes, there's one. And what's that one say?
It says, died Matthew. This one's propped up on a piece of stone. And they all have hands on them inside a circle pointing towards heaven.
Oh, yes.
All of these tombstones have yellow plastic ribbons around them. So somebody...
Yeah, no, they're not yellow.
I mean pink. We're standing in a kind of lovely little field of...
prairie grass.
Kind of pleasantly, unpredictably shaped. And it's got some nice big trees in it. This looks like an oak tree over here. And then there's a pine tree.
And it's got a pretty well-kept fence with good black posts, I think, quite appropriate for a little country cemetery.
Right. Well, they're very solidly built, so they probably have withstood many, many years. The tombstones are kind of hidden in between the prairie grasses. Very thin slabs, maybe about 4 inches thick, and most of them are kind of teetering at an angle. And on one side of us is a cornfield, and beyond the cornfield you can see the animal disease lab.
Yes, that's right.
And on the other side is a pond.
Very romantic looking pond, which I guess people suspect may have some tombstones in the bottom of it. Well, let's go explore some more. Oh, this is
buried in the weeds. And it says...
died on May 1861. She
died on May 11th, 1861, aged 15 days.
Right.
A baby that died.
And this is 1 year, 3 months, and 2 days.
Right. She died April 17th, 1860, at 1 year, 3 months, and 2 days.
And what is the name? You see either the names?
And it says, not lost.
Blessed, thought.
Thought, but gone before.
Not lest,
gone. Not lost, best, but gone before. We shall...
meet again?
No. Anyway.
But this is April 17, 1860.
So now let's see. This is... this person was named Wakefield.
C.A. Carrie A. Daughter of M.E. and S.A.
Wakefield.
These were our sisters.
Sisters, and they both died.
And they died within 1 year of each other.
And they both died in infancy.
Yeah.
There are four who died the same year, in 88. And then the others, like one a year, one in 60, one in 61.
Yeah, a lot of these are infant graves.
So there's maybe, what, about 10 gravestones here?
One, two, three.
You feel history here. This is Local Talk Wednesday on KHOI Community Radio, where we explore people stories and events in Central Iowa and in this time and other time dimensions. What you just heard was myself and my co-host, Susan Franson. I'm Ursula Rudenberg, and we're searching for and finding a little-known pioneer cemetery that is just east of Ames. And we did that with the help of Marvin and Kay Scott and Susan's husband, Fritz.
This pioneer cemetery is actually known as the Bloomington Cemetery. It turns out, if you know where to ask, quite a bit can be discovered about it and the people who were buried there. Although time holds many mysteries concerning the cemetery, there are a lot of people who've been interested in it. Amy Yoakum is with us to tell us a little about it. And you are the natural resources specialist for Story County, is that right?
That is correct. Thank you for having me this morning.
When we told you that we were doing this, you gave us a thick packet of clippings and lists of people whose tombstones had been in the cemetery. It seems there's been a lot of things going on since Ursula visited in the 1960s.
Yeah, I think the cemetery has changed quite a bit in that amount of time, and there have been a lot of people doing research on it.
One of the biggest differences was when I visited in the 1960s, I remember there were a lot of tombstones, and now there were really only about 10 left, and there are certainly many more than before.
The list I have, I compiled as many different sources as I could for the cemetery, and I had almost 75 people being buried there at one time. And as you know, since you just visited the other day, you can only find about 10 headstones now.
When did you visit there?
I was there most recently probably about 5 years ago, but the first time was probably about 10 years ago.
Then the Big Girl Scout Project that I learned about through the clippings that you gave me, it was reported in 1977 in the Ames Tribune, that was when most of the headstones were still there, and we located one of the Girl Scouts over in Nevada. Cassie Harrell, are you there?
I am.
First, we should probably explain how the Girl Scouts got involved.
Can you tell us, Cassie?
It was kind of a service project. Our Girl Scout leader at that time was Shirley Gray, and I'm not even sure who she contacted, but she was a member of the Isaac Walton. And so we would go camping on the weekends there, and I'm not sure exactly how we got involved in it, but through our cadet years, we would go down there and work on this cemetery.
Well, according to a newspaper article in the Ames Tribune in 1977, one of the Girl Scouts stumbled across the cemetery almost accidentally and discovered it. There was a decision of the Girl Scout troop to kind of restore the cemetery.
It was kind of a cute little cemetery, actually, very overgrown with weeds and stuff. We would camp, like I said, over the weekend, and we would go and work a whole day on a Saturday and part of a Sunday. And we would go down there and we would weed and we'd work around the gravestones to try and find where everything was. There were a lot of crumbled grave markers there, and we would take and try and piece them together and just kind of set them in an area, hoping that maybe somebody would come and restore those grave markers and set them back up. We wanted the cemetery to be a cemetery again instead of just a weed pile.
Did you find the gravestones in rows, or were they scattered?
My best recollection is they were kind of in rows to start with, and then they kind of got scattered around throughout the cemetery.
Did the Girl Scouts enjoy working in the cemetery?
Oh, sure we did.
Why did they like doing that?
It's just a piece of history.
Uh-huh.
And we wanted to try and restore it. I mean, we've got a lot of public cemeteries out there that are well cared for. And we found this little cemetery, and I don't know, just a piece of it just kind of touched our hearts. So we just wanted to take and clear it out. And, you know, some of our scouts were into genealogy and that kind of thing, too. So they liked the oldness and the vintage look of the cemetery.
Did you find anybody that you knew in the cemetery?
No.
Well, Amy Yoakum is here with us, and Amy, you gave tours of the cemetery, is that correct? Can you tell us a little bit about it?
I never actually was able to take people to this particular cemetery, but out of the 52 cemeteries in the county, I would consider about 15 of those an old pioneer cemetery just like Bloomington.
Uh-huh.
So I would take them to some of the other ones that were a little bit more accessible than the Bloomington was.
So this was what you would call a pioneer cemetery.
Yeah. I believe the technical term for a pioneer cemetery is that they had to have had less than 8 burials in the last 50 years. And most certainly no one has been buried at the Bloomington Cemetery for a very, very long time.
You came after the vandalism. And one of the questions I'd ask quickly to Cassie is, did the vandalism happen while you were a Girl Scout?
No.
It didn't.
I don't know if somebody had vandalized it to begin with, but it was so overgrown with weeds and stuff, it was kind of hard to tell.
No, this was after you worked on it.
It had been after we worked on it.
So after you fixed the cemetery up, did you show it to anybody? Did you advertise to people that you had done this?
I don't know if Shirley ever did or not. None of us girls ever did. And then, of course, we also had Luann's mother, who Luann was one of my fellow Girl Scouts. She would come and help us, too, and she was just very much she worked at the courthouse, and she was the caretaker of the grounds outside. And she would come with us and help us also, and digging around, finding the grave markers, and I don't know, it's just something about that little cemetery just kind of touched us.
Well, I understand what you mean. I think it touched us, too, when we were there on Sunday. There's something very peaceful about it, and I can see why you kind of adopted it as a really beautiful spot to be. This is Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, and if you just tuned in, we're speaking with Amy Yoakum and Cassie Harrell about a little-known pioneer cemetery in our area known as the Bloomington Cemetery. And Amy is the natural resource specialist for Story County, and Cassie lives in Nevada and keeps in touch with her friends from the Girl Scout troop, and you were one of the people that actually originally discovered the old cemetery after many years and helped fix it up.
Amy, while you're with us, do you have anything else to tell about the things you actually did with the cemetery? You gave us a lot of leads that we're going to follow up in a few minutes.
You know, Bloomington was one of the oldest towns in the county, and some of the burial dates from Bloomington are from the mid-1850s. So that's really quite old. And William Allen wrote the first history book of Story County, which was published in 1887, I believe. And most of the people in the cemetery are known as the really old pioneer people in the county. This is where some of the very first settlers lived in the Bloomington area, and they're very well-known names, I think even throughout today, for being pioneers that settled here very early.
Maybe if we have time, I'll tell about the way people can find out more about those people through Find a Grave and Dorian the Historian.
When we were at the cemetery, we actually started to talk about Bloomington and, kind of realized that this cemetery belonged to the town of Bloomington, this pioneer town. And so we decided to see if we could figure out where the town was, because we had heard there was a so-called a 10-minute walk away from the cemetery. So we have a short recording up here of us trying to find where the town was.
Right over there. See a roof?
Yeah.
That's where Bloomington was.
Yeah,
like that.
Do you know how big Bloomington was?
When I got there, and I don't, that was a long time ago, my impression was that that Bloomington was about a square, about a block on a side, maybe just a bit more.
Mm-hmm.
The streets were still there as sort of country lanes, and there were some residences there. And, of course, these days you can drive to that set of residences down a driveway coming in from Dayton Road. But it's off Dayton Road.
There it is. Another house over there.
Yeah. Do you think that house was an original Bloomington house?
No, it's much too modern. There's a house right ahead of us.
Uh-huh.
If you were living in Bloomington, you could walk to the cemetery. Mm-hmm. It's a matter of a 10-minute walk at most.
I couldn't believe that the house across the field was on the site of the former town of Bloomington, because I had the idea that the town was located on Old Bloomington Road, which still exists, connecting Stagecoach Road with Dayton Road.
You were pretty stubborn about that. So how did you finally figure it out?
Well, you know, in science fiction, it's technology that makes the journey possible. Well, in searching for old cemeteries and those buried there, the technology can give amazing help. Online, through the website of the Ames Historical Society, I was able to locate maps going back to 1886 and comparing them with what's there now. And also, one of the best maps was actually one that Amy gave me, which I never could find where that came from. But that the angle of the road showed me it couldn't be Old Bloomington Road that exists today. It had to be something else.
Amy, can you tell us a little bit more about the town?
I don't know a lot about the town itself. Mm-hmm. You know, we have quite a thick file of all things Bloomington at our library at McFarland Park, and that's where I photocopied the things that I gave to you. I think that there were a number of houses, a school, possibly a post office that were all laid out, but then when the railroad did not end up going through Bloomington and went through Ames instead, just like a lot of the old towns in Story County, it was kind of its demise.
Yeah, that's interesting, because the story that was always circulating when I was a teenager was that there was this town that preceded Ames and they were all wiped out by a plague. But your explanation sounds a lot more plausible.
Yeah, I was able to find out how a few people died in Bloomington, such as pneumonia, typhoid fever, and consumption, but they really didn't start doing actual official death records until the 1880s, and a lot of the people buried here were much before that. So unless it was written down somewhere, you really have a hard time finding out how they actually died.
Actually, there's a very good chapter in Farwell Brown's first book. The school, incidentally, was founded even before the town. And the secretary's report for 1873 shows the number enrolled to have been 38, with an average daily attendance of 26. The same report indicates that there were 23 males and 19 females between the ages of 7 and 14 in the district that were not enrolled at any school at that time. So there were a lot of people living out there.
One of the things that I noticed when we were out there looking at it was that the area where Bloomington was essentially an oak savanna, which you don't see a lot around here anymore, but there was definitely very, very old trees there.
Most of the cemeteries that I found are placed because the land probably wasn't farmable. Mm-hmm. So right on that edge, you know, near a river in the big trees, it wasn't flat enough to farm necessarily, kind of tucked away. And also being accessible by roads. You know, if the Stagecoach Road went close to there, it was important that people could get to the cemetery to visit the people as well.
So how many pioneer cemeteries are actually left?
Technically listed probably about 15, but, you know, maybe five or six of those are just random reports of a burial being on a farm, just one or two bodies that may or may not actually even be there anymore. Mm-hmm. I would say there's around 10 that are the little ones tucked away that nobody really knows where they are. Mm-hmm. And those are the ones I like to take people to show them about that history of where they are.
Well, it's interesting how informal it is. I mean, when you go to the Bloomington Cemetery, it's extremely informal. It's just this little cemetery kind of randomly in the middle of nowhere with no fanfare at all.
Yeah, and there are a number that actually are you know, covered in prairie. So mm-hmm. if you think about, you know, those people that were buried that long ago and covered by that native vegetation, that's what it always was. Mm-hmm. It's kind of the cultural and the natural resource world working together.
So we're talking about the Bloomington Cemetery, which is not spooky at all. It's actually very lovely and pleasant place. And we're talking about the old town of Bloomington, which preceded Ames in this area, which died out kind of when Ames became stronger.
I'd like to read a little description mm-hmm. of Bloomington from Farwell Brown. The abundant woodlands to the west and south of the Bloomington village provided one of Iowa State's famous graduates, George Washington Carver, with a natural laboratory for his nature walks. He was said to have frequently walked out from the campus, through the woods, and up to the village of Bloomington
on Sunday mornings and slipped into the back seat in the Bloomington Chapel. Carver, Iowa State's first black graduate, was aware of the natural resource of his native woodland area. The Bloomington Chapel eventually became independent, and many of the residents affiliated with the Methodist Church in fast-growing Ames. The Bloomington School graduates returned for reunions throughout the 1930s and up to World War II. Reunions have not been resumed since. But in the website from the Ames Historical Society, you can see huge classes out in Bloomington in the very early years of the 20th century. And, well, you can see there are a lot of children living out there. It was in operation for 90 years.
With a prairie town like this, what was there? You know, Susan has mentioned a school, a church. What else would be in a town like this, since there's no buildings left from Bloomington?
Well, Hannum's Mill, which was relatively close on the Skunk River, would have been a place where people were milling their lumber. Or Soper's Mill, which was even up a little bit farther on the river, started out as a lumber mill and then eventually turned into a grist mill for flour and wheat. So, you know, mills, post offices, people were mostly farming around these communities.
Lots of small farms.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. With big families.
Amy, when you bring people to these cemeteries, or when you used to, did they enjoy going to them?
Yeah, there's a select small group of people that find this kind of thing very intriguing. And a lot of it is explaining the artwork that's carved on some of the stones. Mm-hmm. You know, Story County got air compressed tools about 1900. So anything before that is marble or limestone headstones. And they were hand carved with a wooden mallet. And some of the artwork, it just is amazing that someone was able to do that by hand. So after 1900, you know, it switched to being the granite stones, which mm-hmm. were using the heavier tools. And the artwork kind of falls off because they couldn't be that intricate after that time.
Mm-hmm. We noticed the there were many that had a hand with a finger pointing up. And the baby graves had little lambs on
them.
Little
lambs, yeah.
Yeah. The finger pointing up is the sign of the benediction or a blessing. And then lambs and doves most often for children mm-hmm. as a sign of, for a lamb, the good shepherd, or a dove for peace mm-hmm. and innocence.
Well, we're talking about the Bloomington Cemetery, and there's certainly, one thing we learned is there's certainly a lot of people died young. A lot of babies died.
And several mothers died around 20.
That's right.
I'm afraid we're going to have to leave
this thank you.
Past.
Thank you, Amy.
You're welcome. Thanks so much for having me this morning.
We've been speaking with Amy Yocum, who is the Natural Resource Coordinator. Did I get that title right?
That's cool, yeah.
And thank you, Amy. You're a great resource for us in many, many ways at K2I. So it's great finally to have you in the studio.
Thank you.
Susan, you went to chase the pumpkins.
That's right. That's our tuning into agriculture for today.
Okay.
Before I talked to Deanna Black, the director of fun at the Center Grove Orchard, I think probably most people don't think in Iowa that orchards are farms, but we'll hear how this one developed. And it's like many things, though, it's just a surprise. We approached it from I-35. We took exit 120 and we drove 3 miles east and through cornfields, and I thought, I know it's there, but there must be some mistake. And then we saw a sign, and then we saw what looked like a hillside that would be a paradise for children. And that's what I asked Deanna about when we started our interview.
Deanna Black, Director of Fun at Center Grove Orchard. This was our children's paradise growing up. This is where we all grew up. My father bought the land in 75, and it started out, part of it was with Clyde Black and Son Seed Farms, and then he purchased some of the land on his own. And as the years evolved, myself, and I've got 3 siblings, this was our playground. And So Larry Black was my father. He passed away in 99. He was with Clyde Black and Sons, so that was outside of Ames. Clyde Black, back in his day, was known as the Iowa Corn King. He had created the highest yielding hybrid of corn when he was at Iowa State College. So he began Clyde Black and Sons Seed Farms, and then his son Julius continued on with that. And then they had Larry, Dwayne, Gene, and one daughter, Nancy, who contributed with that farm as well. As the years went on, then Clyde Black and Son dissolved, and Dwayne went his way with Black's Heritage Farm, and Gene and Nancy did their own thing, and then my dad continued out here in Cambridge, and with cattle, hogs, corn, beans, typical Iowa farming. The 80s hit, and we needed to diversify, and so my mom, Pat, is originally from Wakanda, Illinois. And her parents had Wakanda orchards. So now you have the beautiful blend of the Black side of the family as well as my mom's side of the family. And now you have apples and orchard and country store meets Iowa farming and agriculture.
Obviously, a few things happened since you started the orchard. When did you start making it a fun place for children?
Right. Agritainment is like the buzzword. Agritourism, agritainment. We began simple with apple orchards, pick your apples, a hayrack ride, school tours, and showing some farm animals. And kids could come out, and we wanted to make it educational and make it fun at the same time. And as that began to grow, and when my father passed away, my brother Steve, he is now the owner-operator of the farm. He has this beautiful vision, very similar to my dad has said too. He had vision as well, and my brother definitely has that too. And he had the whole vision of how can we continue to create a fun environment, make it educational, a place for families to come out and unplug and play and be together. It was about 20 years ago that we went from the farm and the store and then started to evolve more to where we now have our corn pool, which used to be a small little sandbox size, is now almost the size of a swimming pool. And we have a jumping pillow and the slide. So that was about 10 years ago, those things really started adding more fun to it, but still trying to keep a farm feel to it as well. Corn maze, hay maze. We built cute little homes for all the animals to live in, the pig races and the barn show. So having some of these new activities has been a great way to, again, have that beautiful blend of the families coming together, keeping the legacy of the families. And then just recently, the legacy of the land. Part of our land, an old railroad right-of-way, used to cross through it. And so now we have the CGO, Center Grove Orchard Express. We have a train in which is on tracks, which we laid down by hand, and it's just shy of a mile loop. So, and it gives people time to come out and see the scenery of the timber and the cornfields and the pumpkin patch.
How do you power this?
It's a diesel engine. It will hold 48 people. So I think there's going to be 15 cars.
And have you had it in operation long enough to have had it full yet?
We had our big opening where we drilled in or pounded in the last golden spike of the railroad. And so over the weekend, we did have, we have had some full cars. So it's been a lot of fun. It is the one thing that we do charge extra for. However, you do not have to pay the farmyard admission. There's a farmyard admission for access of the entire farm. So however, if you want to come out and if you want to take a hayride or just do the train, you are welcome to do that. And it goes right next to the pumpkin patch. It's 17 acres of pumpkins. And next to the corn maze, which is another 5 acres, 4 to 5 acres of corn.
Well, I have a question about pumpkin patch. Do people come out to actually pick them like they do Christmas trees? Or is it just mostly a family event for jack-o'-lanterns?
It's actually both. We've got some ginormous pumpkins, and people use them just for a display. And then we also have some very decorative pumpkins. People will paint, and then they're carving pumpkins. But we do have some pie pumpkins as well. And I was trying to be creative with what else you can do with a pumpkin. And I carved it out and stuffed it with bread and cream and bacon and cheese and stuck it in the oven for about 90 minutes, almost 2 hours, and it was delicious. And you can just peel right out of that, and you've got a tasty little treat after you've had your pumpkin as a decorative view on your dining room table.
Well, actually, I had a friend years ago who suddenly had daughters who were vegetarians. And so for Thanksgiving, she stuffed a pumpkin. And I didn't ask her how she did it, but I think you've told me, except maybe without the bacon.
Right, but, exactly. But, find other stuff
yes. So maybe stuffed pumpkin for Thanksgiving is going to become a tradition.
It is. It's very delicious. And it's nutritious. Well, it's got some great vitamins and minerals in it that's very healthy for the body.
And when I was going online investigating this story, I saw that you were out of white pumpkins.
We had a tough year with our mini pumpkins and some of the white pumpkins. So we have a few, not a lot. And it was just everything here, again, it's weather related. Why those didn't produce versus the bigger ones, it's just a matter of when did it rain, when was it sunny, and the timing. And surprisingly, I really just found this out more recently, that we have over 30 varieties of pumpkins. So that's a lot of different pumpkins. And same thing, we have about 30 varieties of apples and over 4,000 trees.
And do people still pick a lot of their own apples? Or
we did have U-Pick, where people can come out and pick their own apples. And it didn't last long because it was so popular that they picked them all, which is a great family experience. Sadly, many orchards don't allow U-Pick because a lot of times people don't know really when the apples are ready, even if they're shown which rows or which trees are ready. They get excited and they'll pick an apple and maybe it's not ready yet and they pull the branch down, or other apples fall down, they get on the ground, and people don't want to take those apples when many times they are okay as well. So you want to know if an apple is ready, it should actually twist and pull right off without any tugging. So we did have U-Pick, and then we also have apples in the store. So our U-Pick season is over. All the apples we have available are now in our store.
And who picks those apples?
We have one person that picks our apples for us out of all the trees we have. So he has been an amazing addition to our family here at Center Grove Orchard.
Well, I noticed as we came in that the farmhouse, it says Black House. Is that what it says?
Yes, this is the house that I grew up in. I actually live in Cleveland, Ohio, during the off season, should say. So I am a yoga teacher, fitness trainer, and a stand-up paddleboard coach. And so during that time of year, I'm there. And so September, October, and part of November, I moved back home. And this is the house that we grew up in. My brother lives here now. And it's so nice to come back home to the family home and be able to walk right outside and start to work versus having to commute through the traffic when I'm in Cleveland. So it's a nice.
And I noticed this became up a big red barn. Is that an old barn?
That is the original barn that was on our farm. And so the previous owner before us, they had a small operating farm with a few livestock.
Why don't you describe some of the things that I would have seen on the hillside? I didn't see a corn maze. I didn't see a hay maze. What would I have seen?
Yeah, the corn pool is one of our most famous, I should say, or most popular attractions. And basically, it's hay bales all made in a circle, and we just fill it with seed corn. And the kids just go in there, they take off their shoes, and they're just playing in the corn as if they were playing in a sandbox. And then we have a jumping pillow. We have two jumping pillows, one for the big kids, one for the little kids. We have a slide. We have the hay maze, the corn maze. The corn maze from the aerial view actually looks like it has the CGO Express carved into it. So that's kind of a neat new thing that we've done now. And then after you're finished playing and burning off all those calories in the fresh air, we have a scratch bakery. So everything from our pie crust are made from scratch. And we have an amazing bakery team, production team, that makes apple pie, apple crisp, apple dumplings. We have caramel apples. We have fudge, as well as, and we have cafe sandwiches and nice little treats around the farm. We really want to make it fun, a fun outing where people can come out and create some memories. And so the farmyard is open pretty much September and October.
Well, thank you so much. We've been with Diana Black,
Director of Fun at Center Grove Orchard. It has been such a pleasure talking to you.
Well, thank you, Diana.
And we want to say goodbye to our guest who's been with us during the whole program on our phone, Cassie Harrell. Cassie, you still there?
I am.
Well, thanks for sticking with us on the telephone, and it was really nice to have you here today to describe your work in the Bloomington Cemetery a while back as a Girl Scout.
Well, thank you very much. It was my pleasure.
Well, you've been listening to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, where we explore people, stories, and events in Central Iowa, and thank you for being with us today and listening in. And this week, we not only went to another community, we went to another time dimension. We've been your hosts today, Ursula Rudenberg and Susan Franson. And today we did explore the mysteries of Bloomington Cemetery, and we talked with Amy Yoakum, Cassie Harrell, who is on the phone with us, and Marvin and Kay Scott. They were our guides when we went out last Sunday to find the Bloomington Cemetery. And we also spoke with Center Grove Orchard with Deanna Black, and that was our Tuning into Agriculture segment.
For information about fall color, we talked with Jesse Randall, and Pat Schlarbaum also filed a report for us on Indian summer. Local Talk will be rebroadcast at noon and 7 p.m. You can listen to today's Local Talk show and any of our past Local Talk shows online at our website, khoifm.org. There you will also find information about our guests, along with relevant links to today's stories, and there'll be some very interesting ones today.
Yeah, you found some good information about graveyards.
Yes,
online.
Yes, and I'll put it on our website.
Yeah.
And I should also acknowledge Dorian, the historian, who is the spirit behind a lot of the obituaries that we'll find on Find a Grave. That you'll find that at khoifm.org. And you can like us on Facebook and get updates on all our show postings in your news feed.
Local Talk is engineered by Richard Morrison. Thank you, Rick. Our theme song is Backtrackin' by Al Harris and Tom Richards from their CD, The Ballad of Kate Shelley. Thank you, Al, and thank you, Tom. Other music you heard was Autumn Leaves by Nat King Cole from his CD, Unforgettable.
Local Talk is a radio production training workshop as well as a show. If you would like to join the team as a reporter, contact us at 515-292-2878. That's 515-292-2878.
And we will train you.
Yes.
It's fun.
It certainly is.
Yes.
Or contact us through our website, khoifm.org.
If you enjoyed this show, tell your friends and remember your participation as the listener, as well as your generous contributions, are what make KHOI possible. And starting the 13th of November, we'll be having an on-air fund drive. So please think of us at that time and help us keep KHOI on the air. Thank you for listening. And Susan, take it away.
See you again on the radio.
But I miss you most of all, my
when autumn leaves start to fall.